From the KBIA newsroom in Columbia, this is Intersection, Conversations in Our Community. I'm Sarah Shariari. I love back to school, and this week we're marking the start of a new semester with a series of interviews with professors from across the university. We'll learn about Facebook as the new free speech frontier with Professor Brett Johnson, an extraordinary generation of Afro-Cuban writers and artists with Professor Juana Maria Cordones Cook, and gain a deeper understanding of 20th century U.S. history through superheroes. Yes, we can better understand some things about America through Captain America. So let's get started. Brett Johnson is an assistant professor at the Missouri School of Journalism. Brett looks at the why behind our laws governing freedom of speech and freedom of the press.
I really want to know, how do we as a society engage with our legal regime, our regime of exceptional freedoms for speech, even the most heinous and seditious, hateful types of speech? How do we engage with our exceptional protections for freedom of the press? And I've found, that is often pretty much at any given time a very timely thing to know and to understand, particularly in the political climate that we're living in now. It's a very important thing to understand.
We are in a political climate where there's this very contentious relationship coming from the White House and with the press. Is there anything that's unique about our current climate with the freedom of speech and the press, or is it something that we've seen before?
I think it's a variation on a common theme. What I do think is unfortunate is there's been, as I mean, this is kind of my own opinion, I guess, on this, my own unsubstantiated claims about this. There's been a general, what I've seen is a loss of trust in the institution of the press that's been exploited to the detriment of the many gains that the press has won in courts. So take defamation, for example. The press in the U.S. has unparalleled protections against defamation lawsuits by public figures, public officials. Public officials and public figures have to prove that the press knowingly published false information. That's a very hard standard to prove. Yet we're talking about defamation currently with some of our current public officials, President Trump being one, where I mean, President Trump has even said we should loosen the defamation laws in this country. And I think a lot of people get behind that because the benefit and the value of a reputation, the value of someone's dignity that could be sullied by a harsh and critical report often seems more real to people than this abstract value of the press being a voice for the people, being on the side of the people. And that's dangerous. So one of my areas of research is really trying to understand how we can increase literacy within the news media, within education, of these important freedoms. And in so doing, help rebuild that trust between that relationship of trust between the press and citizens.
And do you sort of look at the reasoning behind the law? You know, why does the law exist the way that it does? Why does the press in the U.S. enjoy these extraordinary protections?
Yeah, no, it's. I mean, it really all begins with the language of the First Amendment. It's what's interesting about it is that it's written in a very unique way. It's written in negative language. Congress shall make no law abridging freedom of speech, press. There's also religion and that in there. I don't really deal with the religion stuff. But that's very different from other countries that say their charters might say freedom of the press is guaranteed to all except when it's not, you know, and that leads to a whole host of exceptions that can be placed in the law in those countries. Courts here have had to deal with what does no law mean? So yeah, a lot of my research begins with that why. Do we do so because we want to create a free and robust marketplace of ideas? Do we do so because we believe that somehow through experiencing even the most heinous ideas, through listening to them, through listening to critical and maybe partially false reports, does that build within us as citizens some higher degree of character as we're able to critically engage with that rather than kind of in a nanny state kind of way being told, no, you can't, that's out of bounds. No one should ever have to deal with that.
And how do you take these concepts and make them real for students? I definitely have heard from students that they really love your class. So how do you make sort of this theoretical law information come home to them?
Well, thank you. That's awesome to hear. So I teach every fall a grad seminar in communications law. And the very first day of class, we begin with theory. Before we get into, you know, we'll do 1 week on defamation, 1 week on prior restraint, 1 week on invasion of privacy, et cetera. By beginning with theory, I think it really disarms a lot of students, many of whom come to the class with either preconceived notions about freedom of speech or freedom of the press, or limited background in it. And a lot of their opinions are very emotionally driven, which is to be expected. I mean, particularly students who have dealt with things such as hate speech, or who have run up against government resistance to providing documents for a story, they're going to have their own emotional reactions when talking about that. And by bringing in the theory, by challenging students to understand why these things exist the way they do, and how that's never really been an easy answer for scholars, for philosophers. I mean, going back to John Stuart Mill in a couple centuries ago, that's never been an easy answer. I think that puts students in a place to really deconstruct these issues and really open their minds up. Having that theory often acts like a traveler's dictionary, if you would. Mm-hmm. You know, you go to a foreign country where you don't speak the language. You pull out your dictionary to ask, where's the bathroom or something like that. Theory is kind of like that. It's the key to understanding this crazy foreign language that is the law.
That may be the most exciting explanation of theory I've ever heard.
Thank you.
And you also look at hate speech and freedom of speech in social media. Mm-hmm. And I think that's probably the space where a lot of us feel, we're seeing some things that we really don't like that may be personal and hateful directed at us. Mm-hmm. What is that landscape like today, and how are these platforms dealing with hate speech?
Yeah, well, currently a project that I'm working on with one of our doctoral students, Kim Kelling, we're looking at so we see Facebook, and Facebook last year went through kind of three really interesting happenings. One was back in June, there was an issue involving their trending feed, that there was an alleged bias, that it was too liberal. And so there were members of Congress who said, we need to have a congressional hearing about Facebook and the power that it has in kind of setting this agenda. Another was Facebook, which kind of is a perennial problem, would take down certain types of extreme content. The big one last year was the photo of the napalm girl from the Pulitzer Prize winning photo from the Vietnam War.
Yes.
And then there was the issue with fake news, and what we started questioning, what role should Facebook play in filtering some of this fake news, particularly if it tends to have a huge impact on public opinion and voting behavior. So what we're looking at is how various media organizations have conceived of Facebook as this new powerful player. Does it have a duty to protect people from harmful speech because it is so easy? There's such a low cost to say such horrible things online. Or does it have a duty to promote a robust marketplace of ideas, to be to kind of be more laissez-faire? Does it have a duty to recognize that it is as much a player in journalism as it is as a social network? And what does that look like? What does Facebook the gatekeeper look like? What does Facebook the agenda setter look like? Facebook is the new arena in which we deal with extreme ideas, hate speech, ideas that, before Facebook might have existed on the street corner at Speaker's Circle, right? You could just walk by and ignore it if you wanted to. It's almost impossible to ignore it today. So how do we deal with that?
This is Intersection on KBIA 91.3 FM, and that was Professor Brett Johnson of the Missouri School of Journalism on freedom of speech and the new Facebook frontier. Next, I spoke with Juana Maria Cordones Cook, who's a professor of Romance languages. Much of her recent work focuses on Afro-Cuban artists and writers.
I realized that it was a culture that was offering a lot and that was misunderstood, and that people needed to learn really and to understand it. And I started working on Afro-Uruguayan theater and Afro-Latin American theater. That is one of my last books. I did an anthology with theater from practically all Latin America. And while I was doing this, I came to meet a poet from Cuba, Nancy Morejon, who introduced me to the intelligentsia in Cuba, particularly the Black intelligentsia. And I realized that in Cuba, there had been a development of intellectuals and artists of African descent stronger and more lasting than in any other Spanish American country.
And I think people understand that slavery and the slave trade brought Africans to North America, but also throughout all the Americas, to Cuba, to different islands, and all throughout the South American continent.
Well, I would like to add something to what you just said, Sarah. And it is the fact that of the millions of slaves who were brought to the Americas, only 5% came to the United States.
Wow, I did not know that.
95% went south of the United States. And I think that that is a piece of information that is not too well known, and people need to keep in mind in order to realize why there has been such a prevalence of people of African descent in Latin America. Even in my own Uruguay, we have an Afro-Uruguayan culture, which has not been developed intellectually like in Cuba, unfortunately.
And it's interesting. I lived in Ecuador and Bolivia for 7 to 8 years. Mm-hmm. And even those countries, I mean, you don't think of those Andean countries, which are very indigenous, as having African descendant populations. But they are. They're very mm-hmm. small, but they're there, and they're culturally quite cohesive.
That's true. Well, that's the way it is all over. And I think a part of the cohesiveness is not only because of the commonality of backgrounds, legacies, but also because of segregation mm-hmm. and prejudice that they encounter.
Who is your favorite Afro-Cuban poet to read?
Well, Nancy Morejon, by far.
Do you have any of Nancy's poetry memorized by any chance?
Gosh, there is a short one I think I can remember, but I remember it in Spanish. You see, from the 16th century comes my pain, and I hardly knew it because the nightingale always sings in my pain. This is a poem which I really like very much because it is very subtle, but it's talking to us about the slavery in the 16th century and how singing, which is really a metaphor for poetry, was a way of sublimizing her pain.
That was really beautiful. And when you're talking with your students, I imagine that there's a very small percentage of students here who are of Afro-Latin American descent or who have even been to Cuba. How do you sort of share this experience that's very foreign to a lot of the students with them, and what do you think they take away from it?
I talk a lot about contrast, and I share with them films. I explain to them the culture. I have brought quite a few of these Afro-Cuban artists here. And the students have absorbed this with tremendous interest because I think that here in the United States, we always talk about the Harlem Renaissance. And in my understanding, what happened in Cuba after the revolution was very similar. And I call it the Havana's Black Renaissance. And so students are introduced into this world. And I feel that they are very interested and fascinated. They love meeting these artists and writers. And it's a way of enriching their experience. And they absorb it very happily, I think.
And you've also been nominated for an Emmy for some of your film work. Mm-hmm. What was that film?
A few years ago, I did the film on Dr. Elliot Battle, who was, I would say, a marvelous educator and leader here in our community. And I did this film with people from the Extension, mainly with Dr. Julie Middleton. We worked with the group, the filming group from the Extension, and it was a film that got incredible distribution really by itself. And it received several awards really in different places. And it was very, very welcome. And Dr. Elliot loved it. According to his daughter, Muriel Battle Browder, he used to watch it almost every night.
And who was Elliot Battle? He was a Colombian.
He was a Colombian. He came from the South. And the reason why I did this film was because he brought a lot of change with gentleness. He was a leader for the civil rights. And all the changes that he and his wife, Dr. Muriel Battle, brought were brought with kindness, without confrontation, but he integrated the schools with his children. He integrated a neighborhood, moving to that place, and always with calmness, kindness, nonviolent. Very much embodying the philosophy of Martin Luther King.
And I suppose the Battle High School is named for him?
Well, actually, the Battle School is named for his wife.
Ah.
But there is a Battle Grade School that was named for him.
Mm-hmm.
And they are almost next to each other in the same street. So it is the Battle area.
And what are you planning to work on going forward? Do you think that, well, I suppose we don't really know how the U.S. Relationship with Cuba will be going forward, but do you think that your work will be changing in the near future, or will it go on as it is?
I am hoping that it will go on as it is. I already have completed 17 documentaries. I am completing two more now in May. Two of the last documentaries are addressing racial issues in Cuba. Another one is on an incredible dancer who brought Africa to Cuban modern dance. Mm-hmm. And I'm doing another one on what I call Havana's Black Renaissance.
I'm Sarah Shariari for Intersection on KBIA, and this week we're talking with professors from around the University of Missouri in Columbia about their classes and their research. That was Romance Language Professor Juana Maria Cordones Cook. I heard about our next guest, Jonathan Root, from a student. I was curious about what I could learn about American culture through superheroes, and it turns out the answer is a lot.
I start in the 20th century. So, mm-hmm. For the past, you know, 100 some odd years, why are superheroes so popular, and where basically did they come from?
Where did they come from?
So the way I start the class, so you can go way back to Greek myths, right? You have like Achilles, Hercules. But what I start to kind of make the class more manageable, I'm starting with the late 19th century, particularly with the decay of Victorian values, Victorian America, and this rise, what comes to replace it. And one thing that we see happen is So ideas of race, class, and gender are central to understanding superheroes. And so I started with my first real lecture, I guess you can say, was about Teddy Roosevelt's attempts to revitalize American manhood through war, through imperialism, also through sports, particularly things like boxing and football. He loved football. Both his sons played football. And so his attempt to create the perfect man, right, the muscular man who was tough, he was intelligent. So that is what comes to represent what it meant to be an American man, was to be vital and athletic and strong.
And what was quote wrong with American men before this?
So basically what they said is that the way the Victorian home was set up, so the home was a place where men were going to be domesticated, right? So you have capitalism in the 19th century, kind of market-driven economy. It was super competitive. And so the idea was that, well, men are inherently violent and aggressive. So they go home, they learn to be basically adopt some feminine qualities, like self-control, to control your emotions, control kind of your animal instincts. And so the idea was that they had gone too far, right? Particularly, they blame women, of course, that women had domesticated men too much. So you have that. We also have changes in the nature of work. So I guess it's primarily the white middle class. We're going to see most of them are going to move away from the rural areas. They're no longer farmers. They don't own their own shops or their fathers had, or their grandfathers had. And they become what people at the time called brain workers. So law clerks, bank tellers, managers. So basically white collar work. And so the combination of losing that, of losing the what people thought meant to be a man was to own property, to own land, or at least a shop.
And to work it physically.
Yes, right. And so this idea was that, well, we have this going on, that men are becoming basically too feminine. They are brain workers. So the idea was that they're losing their vitality. Another thing you see is, this is when we first begin to see like consumer culture. One thing that comes with consumption, or came with consumption, was things that save time. So like canned foods, prefabricated furniture, right? And so the idea was indoor plumbing, right? So the fear was that all these things had made men soft, right? You no longer had to go hunt for your game, right? Mm-hmm. You just go to the store, buy a can of beans, and that's your meal. And so this idea that we need to reinvigorate American manhood. And I think you see that clearly in superheroes, particularly early ones, right? They are generally white men. There's something that's fierce and powerful about them. But they're still genuinely like good people, like Superman. He's basically all-powerful. But
and what year was Superman created?
1938.
Okay, so this is very much like a 20s and 30s
it
sort
is,
of moment.
It is, yes, yeah. So I started there. And yes, Superman, Captain America, right? He wears an American flag. But he also stands up for democracy, right? He fights the enemy. The very first issue of Captain America was March 1941. Front and center is him punching Hitler, right? And so you have this image of superheroes being these white men who protect democracy. They protect the innocent. So I start there, and then I'll talk about eugenics, kind of this attempt to create the perfect human.
Mm.
And superheroes are basically perfect people.
And they've always come under some sort of process that's made him them that perfect
person.
It's
like Captain America, right? He was made in a lab, right? They use science to create the Superman, the superhero. And so you have, again, these perceptions of weakened manhood. You have this sense of we can use science to perfect humanity, and those people can be used for good things. And then I continue on. And so basically what I do is I have the course set up in many ways. It's a survey of American 20th century history. But I'm doing that through the lens of superheroes. So if we look at a particular time period, how do superheroes reflect that time period? And how do they help shape that time period? How do they shape generations? And so I'll have stuff, of course, on the Cold War.
Yes.
I'll have a whole section on women's rights and superheroes.
Is that when Wonder Woman came to be?
Wonder Woman came in 1941, actually.
Really?
And she was explicitly created to be a feminist icon.
Really?
Yeah.
I thought the whole point of superheroes was that the women had too much power over the men.
So that's what was interesting about, actually, Wonder Woman early on, is that she was... The name of the creator is escaping me at the moment. but he was for much of the 20th century, a supporter of radical feminism. And so his idea of Wonder Woman was, again, that you have all these masculine characters, but where's women, right? Women need some kind of a role model the way men and boys have. And so that was his intention. But as he eventually begins to give up some creative control, and when he dies in, I believe, 47 or 48, we see Wonder Woman go back to become a domesticated woman. And so we do see that, again, particularly with female superheroes, and Wonder Woman is the best example because she's probably the best known. She goes in these patterns. Come the 60s and 70s, right, she's basically captured again as a feminist icon. Mm. There was that famous magazine, Ms. She's on the cover of Wonder Woman, again, as this feminist icon. And so we see superheroes are not going to be static, right? Our ideas of them change over time, and they really reflect the anxieties of generations, but they also represent for many people what it means to be an American, right? Particularly who's in and who's out.
Mm-hmm.
How do these people stand up for American values? And so we see the rise of the first black superheroes in the 1970s of Luke Cage and Black Panther, and their stories, their creators use them to address particularly problems in the black inner city. So Luke Cage is from Harlem, right? And he fights corrupt government officials. He fights corrupt landlords in the inner cities, right? In these tenements, mm-hmm. in these, housing projects. So we see them used to kind of fight that white authority, basically, kind of try to overthrow white supremacy. And oftentimes their creators create them with that stuff in mind.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how can we use these people to challenge the status quo? But at the same time, superheroes have been used to uphold the status quo. Superman might be one of the best examples of one that's been done to do that.
That was visiting Professor Jonathan Root on what we can learn about American culture and history through the lens of a national fixation, superheroes. This is Intersection on KBIA 91.3 FM, and that's our show for this week. Thank you to our guests, Professors Brett Johnson, Juana Maria Cordones Cook, and Jonathan Root. And thank you to our producers, Claire Banderas, Abby Ivory Gagne, and Kelly Polacek. If you want to listen to this show again, you can visit us online at kbia.org and find us at Intersection under the Shows tab. You can also follow us on Facebook to stay up to date with our show. Our music is Montana Skies. I'm Sarah Shariari for Intersection here on KBIA 91.3 FM.